Hello, and welcome to The Raw Bar. I'm Goddess Cecilia, pleasure educator and consultant, and I will be your host. I've invited my friends and colleagues to sit, snack, get real, and probably a little salty about sexuality and pleasure. We've also saved a seat for you. And because of the nature of this podcast, we want to make sure that you're aware that there will be conversations about sexuality, sexual acts, probably some spicy language, and a bunch of other things that are definitely not appropriate for younger ears. So give yourself some solo time if you can. Grab a drink like tea, wine, water, or boba. Don't forget your snackies. Ease in and get comfy. Here's to a pleasurable time together. This season of Raw Bar with Goddess Cecilia is brought to you by MysteryPleasureBox.com. Surprise yourself with a subscription to MysteryPleasureBox.com, a fun and affordable way to discover new sex toys and novelty products every month, billed and delivered discreetly. You get an arsenal of potions, lotions, sex toys, and bedroom accessories picked by industry experts. Every box you receive is packed with high-quality, full-size, brand-name products from brands you know and love. So sign up at MysteryPleasureBox.com and use code GODDESS for 10% off your first box. Welcome to the Raw Bar. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, okay. Let me read your bio before I get carried away. Because that tends to be what happens. I'm like, focus. Okay. So Lila, pronouns she and her, is an author, stripper, anti-misogyny advocate, and founder of A Stripper's Guide, where she teaches strategies for deepening interpersonal intimacy through an anti-oppression lens. She is passionate about helping people step into their unique power by examining the ways that both our personal experiences and broader social systems impact the way we understand ourselves, each other, and the worlds that contain us. She is currently writing a book about how to bring justice and liberation strategies into our personal lives for more satisfying relationships. You are doing so many amazing things, and it's been really cool to watch it all unfold.
Buddy, and like, it's just thank you.
Really exciting. Seriously, I'm serious. This is part of the reason I say this every week, but part of the reason I decided to do this is because I'm like, God, I know a lot of cool people. And I'm a little bit showing off at all the cool people that I think that it's like, it's my way to boost other people and mm-hmm. see people's faces who I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah. That's definitely like the reason that I got really excited about my podcast. At first I started my podcast and I was like, I don't know, I just want to talk about shit. But then when I realized I could invite other people onto it, I was like, ooh, now this is like a self-serving strategy to talk to awesome people all the time.
I know, it's a little bit sneaky, but not.
Well, right. Can I be a little bit sneaky? Because sure. Since this is also going to go on my podcast, can I just throw a curveball and ask you to introduce yourself and tell folks about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a sexuality and pleasure educator. Sometimes you'll find me in a mermaid tail. Sometimes you'll just get, you can't see because it's too low. Seashell bra situation on my clothing, which now that I have a toddler, I'm always like, what must people think? And then I'm like, fuck those people.
Yeah.
Whatever. If they don't get the mermaid thing, then we're not friends.
Yeah. Like listeners, Cecilia is an actual mermaid, like an embodied practicing mermaid. And it's beautiful. Yeah,
I've made this distinction before. I'm not like pro level because there are like pro level, like diving, swimming mermaids. I don't get into water as often as I'd like to, but whew. If I had a pool, the content would be very different.
You are spiritually a mermaid.
Yes.
Yes. Very.
I do have tails, so it's not like I'm totally just pretending.
You're the most mermaid I've ever met.
Oh, that's an honor. And so one of the things that I like to do is I like to share the like a beverage or food with my guests because it's like, I feel like it helps to create that sort of we're chilling together situation. So what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a little cup of chamomile tea. How about you?
Oh, I recently bought myself a milk frother. And so I made an espresso for myself. And I was like, I just want to froth everything.
Oh, that's next level. That's fancy.
Yeah, I got fancy for you.
I'm drinking out of this cute, this is like my favorite cup at my dad's house. My dad lives, his house is like a wizard's cottage in the woods. If, I don't know if you've ever seen The Sword in the Stone, the cartoon from the 60s, yeah. But my dad like is Merlin. So he has all these so cute exciting. Little mismatchy cups and plates and books and plants and cats.
Aw, that's so cute. Oh my gosh. All right, so let's get into it. What is your stripper / sex worker / advocate / social justice origin story? Tell us about how you became you.
I am sure that this all started in childhood. And I've always been like I do what I want type of person. And also, really luckily for me, I have parents who just let me do whatever I want, or at least they realized pretty early on that it was gonna be a futile effort to try and control me. And so I luckily grew up with a very strong sense of myself, and that by the time I was like in high school, I was considering stripping. I was like, this is something that I might be interested in at some point. I'm not opposed to it. I loves like stripper aesthetic and stripper glam. And so it was a really, it wasn't like a huge decision for me to start dancing. And it was a big decision because I was scared. I didn't know any strippers that I knew of. And, but luckily I didn't have the kind of relationships where I was afraid I was going to lose people if they found out. And so that is such a huge factor for so many people entering sex work. And so it was, for me, not the it wasn't a risk to try it. And but once I was in there, I became very aware of who in my life was starting to like view me differently and how it was starting to affect my relationships with some people, not with others. And then I also saw reflected back to me in that in the industry dancing from my first shift, was hearing stories from other dancers who were experiencing controlling partners who were trying to shame them for dancing or wanted them to stop dancing or wanted them to perform certain services at work and not other services at work. And being able to just so clearly see like how that happens, like it's so obvious like that because there's controlling partners, people who are femme or perceived by others to be femme are susceptible to that. No matter what. And I had already been in an abusive relationship by the time I started dancing. I started dancing at 25. And so what it did for me, what becoming a stripper did for me, I did not intend to have my sort of social justice claws sharpened in the strip club industry or the sex industry. But what happened is I saw this huge hypocrisy between how society perceives strippers. As I was losing my own biases about sex workers and strippers, I was starting to strip away my own. Because when I went into the industry, I fully thought that I was better than people who do full service sex work, which is full service sex work is for people who don't know, like people who engage with do perform like sexual act, you know, like intercourse and oral sex and all that. And stripping, me being just dancing, I noticed that I had a lot of those biases going in, and a lot of my coworkers had those biases, and a lot of my coworkers, there's a lot of strippers who think that they're like better than full service sex workers. But also, this is all over the place, but part of the reason why I thrived in the strip club industry and not in regular jobs, or when I say regular, traditional jobs, is because I haven't sought diagnosis yet, but it's on the radar for this year. I suspect I'm on the autism spectrum and like probably have ADHD. And so there's a lot of reasons why I was not able to hold the kind of work hours or consistent schedule that was required of me in high school and in my jobs after high school. And so stripping like really made sense for me and worked well for me. And also, this is so long-winded.
No, it's all good. I love it. I love it.
It's long-winded because I'm fucking...
It's an origin virgin. Story. It's your life. Yeah. It's your life.
I can't talk in a straight line, so here we are. But part of my story, that the reason I wanted to give all of that in context is I'm white and was raised by a white self-proclaimed feminist mother who works in academia. I went to college. I graduated college. I got my bachelor's degree in anthropology, which is a whole world of wildness in and of itself, because it's anthropology is like the study of culture, which in and of itself is not a bad thing, except it's the study of anthropology as a field started out in the hands of white people going into indigenous and black and non-Western communities and observing as though they were observing animals in nature rather than developing genuine relationships, cross-cultural relationships that were equitable and fair. I think it was started off as a sort of a voyeuristic endeavor on the part of white academic institutions. And of course, now, these days, there are plenty of BIPOC, Indigenous, queer, feminist anthropologists who are changing the way the field works. And I do believe that education is like the one institution that we can change from within, because education is not the like property of white supremacy. We need to strain it out from white supremacy. But so I was raised in the, I like to say that like white feminism was my first language. And I was raised with these like judgments around sex workers, this idea that sex workers are all like victims in need of saving and that we should abolish the sex industry. And this is the sort of thinking that my mom had when I went into the industry. And to this day, we are not able to have a relationship. We didn't have a relationship before I went into the industry, but part of the problem is that once I became a sex worker, I became illegitimized as an academic in her eyes and in the eyes of many academics. And like so many sex worker activists, which is not even, I don't know if I call myself a sex worker activist. It's certainly not what I started out with an intention of being, but those of us who advocates, I'll say advocates, like sex worker advocates, just for the advocacy of us as like full multidimensional human beings who are capable of a scope of human behaviors and endeavors, just like any human being, like academia itself and liberalism and white feminism, and which is also mainstream feminism, like illegitimizes us in a way that silences us and decentralizes us from conversations about us and contributes largely to the reason why sex workers are so stigmatized and also why it's so difficult for sex workers who want to leave the industry to actually exit in a way that is viable. And so coming from the world of academia and whiteness and white cis womanness, I recognized that, and a survivor of partner violence, and then later a survivor of queer partner violence and being a stripper, all of these things together, I realized that I am positioned, and being a stripper whose family and friends generally support me, like I realized that I am in a position for advocacy. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
No, but all of that is first of all, extremely relevant to who you are. I have to say, like, there's a lot of what you said that I also found in my work, which is, it's funny because I do feel like I sell sex toys. That's like literally the sex industry, but it's one facet of the sex industry.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
And in the beginning, I certainly separated myself from being part of that industry. It was like, no, I'm just, it's retail. And yes, and you can also belong to like multiple industries, multiple identities. And there's 100% definitely a lot of whorephobia, a lot of slut shaming that I remember hearing in a lot of different people's, like they would do demonstrations for the company, right? So that people could see what it looks like from some of the like top sellers or whatever. And just hearing some of the extremely shamey things that were coming out of some of these people, it was like, no, like it, ha- like how can we be part of the industry and then shame other people who are also part of the industry? It doesn't make sense. But it comes from the idea that, like, oh, I'm somehow better because I'm not performing specific acts. And it's like, there's no better or worse. We're all going to struggle a little bit with, like, how to put this on our resume, potentially, if we're then going to attempt to try to get some regular, yeah, traditional, like, 9-to-5 type job. And also, I have to say, like, also the people not really understanding, like, family members not really understanding what you're doing is such a thing. Lila, I don't know if you know this, but to this day, my mom once in a while is, we don't have a dentist in the family. And I'm literally like, a dentist? Of all the things that you think I should be doing.
Oh my God.
Dentistry is not it. And I used to joke that, like, I used to joke that they must believe that I'm literally, like, on the side of a highway entrance selling dildos out of a bag. What do they think that I'm doing? And it is this, even though I've tried explaining it to them, like, I've literally hosted parties at my house. They've seen me do the work. They're still, like, not capturing what it is that I'm doing and, like, the educational piece and the relationship to health and this the advocacy part as well, which is, for considering that my dad is a union organizer, retired, but a union organizer, like, sometimes I'm like, it's literally how you raised me.
And bro, oh my God, I know. Like, that's how I feel too. I'm like, Mom, like, you raised me this way and you created a beast that's out of control now, but it's, I am a Frankenstein of your own creation. The great irony.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And can I ask you a little bit about
sure
your advocacy and, like, that?
Oh, sure. A lot of it, I had to take a little bit of a step back, but a lot of it was, I was doing a lot of the advocacy, like, within the company.
See, like, pleasure advocacy? Or?
Oh, yeah, pleasure advocacy, but also definitely along the, like, diversity, equity, inclusion line without the title or the pay, which I'll get into one day. But in my mind, I felt like it was one of those, okay, this is the position that I'm in. I'm working for a company that I have the ability to uplift specific voices. If we're talking about how we're supposedly much more inclusive, then we have to be in, like, truly inclusive of everybody and not just, like, specific groups of people. And while the intention was there, there was just not, the follow through was very difficult. And, like, realistically, I never was quiet about this, but, like, I was one of two brown people in the office at the end. And Mana and I made it also really clear that there needs to be more people of color. If we're going to say that we represent everybody should also be represented in the company. And then trying to do, like, the educational piece with folks as well. Like, I am very lucky that I was able to do that. And I still try to use my voice in productive ways, even though in the past several years it's gotten more angry. Rightfully, I think. And, like, in the past year I had to take a little bit of a step back, which is mainly why I like quit the office job, because I was like, I'm hitting a wall and it hurts.
Yeah, and good for you for, like, resting and taking the time that you need to recalibrate, because flinging ourselves into walls that hurt is never usually a sustainable practice.
Yeah. No, it isn't. Our walls are pretty, my walls specifically are not as stable as I'd like them to be, but I'm not trying to run into these either.
Yeah. Well,
so you and I met in the belly dance / menat community, which stands for Middle Eastern, North African, Hellenic, and Turkish dance community. And tell me if this is correct, but did we meet in a class or did we meet doing the Rock's Nativity show?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea where we met, but I know that we met in that context of
yes,
menat dance.
Yes. And I feel like for me specifically, because I was seeing a lot of the sort of, like, sex avoidance, sexuality avoidance that was happening in the belly dance community, as well as the whorephobia that was happening at my day job. But it's always struck me how there is sometimes the language of, oh no, but you don't want to put your hands here because then you're going to be like overly sexual. When I always felt like the dance itself was so much more about being like really sensual and being really embodied. And it always felt like there was, a little bit of a thin line between appreciating performance and performers and then villainizing sex workers. Yeah. If that makes any sense.
Oh, it doesn't make sense, but I'm familiar with the phenomenon.
So I would love to hear your thoughts about this. And I know you're not in that community anymore too much, but if you've seen any sort of changes in the language at all.
Well, yeah. And just to clarify for listeners, Men Not Dance is commonly known under its misnomer belly dance, just so that listeners have an idea of what sort of visually what this dance is, what these dances are that we're talking about. Or maybe you said that already, Cecilia, sorry, but in my head I was like, make sure we tell them that.
No, it's okay. It's good to reiterate.
But yeah, so I have not danced in that community at all for the past 6 years. I left that community not only because stripping made me realize that I really actually much prefer dancing for my own self and not necessarily in front of an audience, which is ironic because of course stripping, like you think of it as in front of an audience, but I don't think of it that way. Like when I'm on stage, I'm like, I'm here, you're welcome. Like, I don't know. Like you happen to be here, but I'm just doing what I'd be doing in my living room.
I love it.
But also I left the Men Not Dance community because of white supremacy, which it runs rampant in that industry in this country, because in this country, that industry is mostly, the power and money in that industry is mostly disproportionately in the hands of white dancers. And I also, early on in my experiences, when I first started dancing in like Men Not Dance styles, I had a variety of different teachers, but a lot of them were white. And I definitely heard a lot of this slut-shamey rhetoric of, we're belly dancers, not strippers. And back then, it was my late teens, early 20s. And that's when I was very much entrenched still in this, like in the white feminism that I was raised in, and couldn't quite recognize what was wrong with it. But oof, let me tell you, from where I sit now, I'm like, oh shit. It's, the issue is like when you filter other cultural expressions through the lens of white feminism, like that doesn't work. And it's appropriative and it's speculative and it's, again, voyeuristic and moralistic. And this idea that like white women in the United States have the authority to decide whether Middle Eastern dances or African dances or like Turkish dances are worthy. Like it's a moralistic sort of judgment on, oh, if this were sexual or sexualized or sex work in any way, it would be beneath me, but I'm doing it, so it can't be that. Right. Like in actuality, like there are certainly, and this is largely to do with colonialism and imperialism, like there are certainly places where belly people who are advertising themselves as different forms of belly dancers, I recognize that word is not great, and I often struggle with how to replace it.
Yeah, agree.
But that's a whole other conversation. But people who are advertising themselves as performers, but it is implicit that they are actually sex workers using dance to advertise themselves. And this is a legitimate way that mostly BIPOC women use, and femmes use these dances, and not just women and femmes, people of all genders use these dances as part of sex work. And that is a perfectly legitimate way to use them. And also that something, just, I see this, it's the same in the pole dance industry. Who are pole dancers, not strippers? And where the fuck do you think this came from? Where do you think this came from?
I didn't know that for real.
Oh my God, it's so bad. Yeah, there's an episode of my podcast called Whorephobia in Belly Dance. I believe that's the title of the podcast. Oh. And it's with myself and my friend Tanisha, and we talk a lot about this in belly dance and in pole dance. It's like a parallel universe. But yeah, it's really this like the audacity of white feminism to presume itself the authority on dances that are not of white origin and make itself the moral arbiter, when really this is about white panic over sex work.
Right. Oh boy. And that's really specific too, to like the US, but also in other places around the world, right? Like some of the top tier ones are like Eastern European, oftentimes, I believe. And even let's say in Egypt, right? A lot of the times the people who are like publicly performing aren't often Egyptian. There's a whole other like cultural context there as well, which is that it's still a little bit looked down upon as an art form. And so it's like, fine if other people do it, but not people in my family sort of situation. Very complicated. And that's like a whole other conversation in and of itself. And so there is still that aspect of like white supremacy.
Yeah.
Like around the world globally as an issue. And I feel like it almost comes down to, not almost, but there's a level of it where people like to separate, oh, but it's like art and performance. And right. It's like, how about it can be all the things? It can be more.
Oh man.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and I think that if you or anybody else is interested, I also have a podcast episode called Decolonizing Stripper Dance. And one of the people that, it was a panel, and one of the people that spoke on that panel is Soumaya Moroz, who is a Moroccan dancer, Rakhsharki dancer. I don't know Soumaya, but she was in Boston for a long time. So she's, that whole conversation is about like that perspective, and also how like sex work is in the eye of the beholder. And as long as sex work is stigmatized, anything that others perceive to be sexual labor, which could be selling sex toys, it could be dancing belly dance, it depends on the cultural context of the viewer and the the cultural context and the beliefs of the viewer. If you are sexualized by the viewer, that automatically puts you at a disadvantage because we live in a global patriarchy. And so the whole it's only valuable if it's art, it's not valuable if it's sex work, so I'm going to make myself feel better by perceiving it as art, when really that's your own judgment about sex work and the value of either or.
And I feel like it's hard for people to wrestle with with those ideas, because there is so much shame attached to it, which is just unfortunate in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So to shift a little bit in terms of the questioning, I'm going to talk a little bit about some relatively recent events, which yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of the Atlanta spa shootings. And even though there wasn't any evidence of the women who were murdered, who were working at these spas, I saw that a lot. It was like, there's no evidence that they're sex workers. And it was like, okay, sure, fine. There was a lot of that initial speculation, because I think there's been a lot of sometimes like crossover with a lot of the like spas. Sometimes there is sex work, sometimes there isn't. And there was so much. The amount of pushback that I saw in the Asian community specifically about whether or not they were sex workers was, I think, well-intentioned, right? Because 100% there is the hypersexualization of Asian folks, specifically Asian women and femmes, right? But then it shifted so quickly into like anti-sex worker language. And it was, when I saw it happening, I felt like it was like a continuous punch in the gut. It was just like, I know what y'all are trying to say, and there's better ways. There's so many other ways that we could talk about this. And I would just like to ask you, like, what do you think are some ways that folks could have been better about that?
Let's take a quick break. Check in with your body. What do you need? Do you need to stretch? Do you need to use the restroom? Do you need some extra water? Do whatever you need to take care of you, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Erica of yourorganizedphotos.com. Do you have photos spread across multiple devices or printed albums that you wish could be online to share with your family? Do you have a hard time finding a photo when you want to? And do you want to make sure those digital photos are safely backed up just in case your device gets lost or crashes? We are living in a time when people can take more photos than ever in human history. Yet these memories can be hard to enjoy if they aren't easy to find and share. And if we don't create a good system to back them all up, our treasured photos are at risk of disappearing into the digital void. But here's where I can help. I love helping folks organize and protect their important images. If you go to yourorganizedphotos.com, you can learn about a number of services, in person and remote, how I can help. yourorganizedphotos.com.
First of all, I just want to say I'm grateful for you to invite me into this conversation. And because that, the shooting, like, oof, like that was such, it was such a devastating event. And one of the, unfortunately, living in the US, I don't know if anybody else has this, but there are like certain mass shootings that like mark big, like emotional transformations in my life, or emotional, I will say like milestones or markers or whatever. Like I can, these, and this one in particular was just so devastating because for anybody who doesn't know what happened, a white gunman went to three different Asian-run massage parlors in Atlanta and killed eight people, most of whom were Asian women. And then when he was arrested, his explanation for why he had done what he had done was claiming that he was a sex addict and that he wanted to get rid of the temptation. The implication there being, I assumed that these women were sex workers in sex, like brothels that are posing as massage parlors, which is a common way that sex workers in a society where sex work is criminalized, like the US and like in so much of the world, it's a front business. Like you say, it's a massage parlor and then it's a brothel. And so this whole conversation that I also saw springing up in my algorithms after that around, these weren't sex workers. These were respectable women. These were moms. These were hardworking family members. That is right back to the patriarchal practice of only legitimizing certain versions of femininity, which is, what if these women had been sex workers? What if they, like, does that make what happened to them less horrible? And unfortunately, in our society, in the mind of the public, the answer is yes. In the mind of the public, we are, sex workers are expendable, and especially sex workers who are not cis, white, thin women. And that what happened was such a travesty of intersectional problems. Like, it was at the intersection of so many different forms of marginalization and stereotyping about both sex workers, but and also about Asian femmes and about immigrant femmes. And I do just want to give an anecdote that I see this at work a lot. I was just a couple of weeks ago talking to my coworker who's Indigenous Brazilian and Thai. And she was like, yeah, when I go into the private room with guys, they always think they can try shit with me because they think that I don't know what's going on, that they don't think that I speak English. They don't think that they're trying to take advantage of her specifically because they target her as an Asian presenting femme who they believe might not understand English and I myself, I'm mistaken as Latina frequently at work. And I only say that to say, I notice a marked difference in how certain men treat me when they think I'm Latina versus when they know that I'm white. And I am much more hypersexualized when folks think that I am not white. And so I think that, like you said, the intention after that, it's people trying to cope with tragedy, people trying to cope with grief, people trying to cope with this unthinkable thing that happened, and like clutching at what makes us feel in control and like feeling like, okay, like this was unjustifiable because these were good women. These weren't bad women. But right. I actually, there's an organization, if anybody wants to go check it out, Red Canary Song, and it's a network, I'm sure Cecilia, you know about them. It's a awesome. Network of, yeah, Asian run, sex worker run, migrant sex worker advocacy. And there's so much, I also just want to say so much of that same stigma in and among sex workers, like in and among ourselves. There is white supremacy. There is just all of the same cultural like oppression that happens out in the world happens within sex worker communities. And like, I hear it all the time. There's so much stigma against immigrant sex workers, especially those who aren't English speaking or who speak English as a second language. Like I see it all the time. I hear it all the time on a weekly basis from American sex worker, from American strippers in my clubs of all different ethnicities. I hear stigma and racism and anti-immigrant sentiments about the girls who don't speak English. And it's this, again, it's whorephobic, it's anti-whore, which is really fucking ironic for a group of hoes. But it's this idea that we don't do extras in the private room, which is full service or services that aren't advertised, illegal services, sexual services that like some strippers do perform. And like this, it's a stereotype amongst strippers that like, oh, we're the English speaking ones and we're like the home base strippers and we don't do those extras like the immigrant women here do, which is a bullshit, by the way. Like,
I was like, it's not true though.
It's not true. But also it's not to be judged in anyone. Like, sex workers are not to judge each other for the services we perform, regardless of race or country of origin.
Wow. Yes. And I think that is just how white supremacy works, right? That is how deeply ingrained it is. Even, and I think about this all the time because I feel like it's so important to like self-examine how it shows up in our own world, even if we're people, I wouldn't say especially, but definitely when we're people of color. Because it is just so all over the place and so like insidious, right? And I feel like there's this level of it that robs people. Obviously, it robs people of their humanity. But especially in this specific topic, there was so much of this, oh, stop hypersexualizing me. But then there wasn't the... I felt like there was a missing statement in all of that, which is that like my sexuality is my own and I get to say express it however I want to express it because it's how I want to express it and not because of these other people. And I know it's hard to, I know how hard it is to separate those ideas because I think there's still constantly a little bit of the wrestling with that for everybody, but it can turn so quickly into a lot of the whore shaming and whore phobia when it's just, no, you can still be sexual and not be hypersexualized. Like,
and you can still be a sex, and you can also be a sex worker and not have it be about sexuality. Yes. Sex work is not about sexuality for me at all. And just like I have, and I think this is skipping ahead because I got a sneak peek at some of the interview questions. So I know you're going to ask this in a sec, but feels relevant to say. I want to be recognized as a worker, not a sexual being, as a sex worker. And on the flip side, people who are not sex workers who do want to be recognized as feeling sexually empowered, or people who are sex workers, doesn't matter what you, if you are a sex worker or not, and you feel like everybody deserves to be free to express ourselves in our sexuality. And if that means intersectional, the person who owns the Intersectional ABC account, which is an Instagram account run by a young Asian woman. She's really young. She's like in her early 20s and she's awesome. She posts a lot of intersectional feminist stuff. And one post she made was like that after these shootings, she got a lot of flack, wrote a comment on one of her pictures where she was dressed all cute and like a little crop top. And they were like, aren't you, by dressing like that, aren't you contributing to the stereotype of Asian femmes as sexual? And that's victim blaming. Let this like young, cute femme express herself however the fuck she wants and do not pin it on her. This, the fact that we as a society hypersexualize Asian femmes,
right,
is... entirely the fault of white men. So let's like refocus that shit where it belongs,
right,
and not scapegoat young Asian women for their own oppression.
Right. Oh boy. Let's get into that, right? Because we do know that people think about sex work with such a morality sort of lens. I actually love that you phrased it that way, which erases literally all of the nuances of sex work. So let's dive more into what people end up missing when they view sex work in this specific morality lens.
We live in a global capitalism, so we must view this first as labor. Like, because what happens when we don't, the majority of the world criminalizes sex work, which means you can be arrested, you can be thrown in jail, you can get a criminal record, you can spend years in prison for prostitution. The people who are disproportionately likely to be arrested are Black people, period, in the US. And so Black femme sex workers, particularly Black trans sex workers, are more likely to experience state violence as a result of doing sex work, because these laws against sex work are about eradicating sex work rather than supposedly as a means to protect us, which is super patronizing. This idea, yes, that like we are as an entity incapable of self-determining our own needs and that we need the state to determine them for us is like wildly detrimental and affects even me as a legal, like I'm a stripper, that's a legal job. And I, all the things I mentioned, I am a cis white woman with a college degree, and I'm not saying my college degree means anything about me, but it gives me access and privilege in ways that like other people don't have. And even I, because we live in a society where sex work is so heavily stigmatized and so criminal, it's criminalized. Like, I am afraid. I run a whole business called A Stripper's Guide. I am afraid of someday having my children taken away from me that I don't even have yet. I don't even have kids. And this is already a fear that I have if ever I had to go to court for anything, even unrelated. So many people have their children taken away just for the mere fact that they're sex workers. People have their children taken away in domestic violence situation and given to the violent partner because they're sex workers. And people are deported. So these are questions of, and actually I wanted to bring up, I brought a book for everybody. It's called Revolting. This is Revolting Prostitutes, The Fight for Sex Workers' Rights by Juno Mack and Molly Smith. It's a very recent book. It was published in 2018 and republished in 2020. And it is a comprehensive, super engaging read that explains, they're both sex workers, both the people who wrote this are sex workers, and it explains why sex workers can and should be at the forefront of global conversations around how sex work is integrated into society, because it is here. And the most of the, in almost the entire world, except for New Zealand, sex work is either criminalized or heavily legally regulated. And the heavy legal regulations may be beneficial for some workers in the very few places that they occur, but they do nothing to help the workers that are not included in those legal bounds, which is most workers. And so sex work is very much an issue of immigration. It's very much because migrant sex workers are some of the most vulnerable and marginalized sex workers in the world. They've got no rights anywhere that they are. And so for sex workers to report things like unfair working conditions, anything from unfair working conditions to sexual assault and violence to scary clients to exploitative bosses, exploitative third party managers or pimps or workers. Like the whole reason that trafficking, all of these fucking, the leading policies around sex work, the majority of the countries that do criminalize it and penalize it, the voices that are centered are not the voices of sex workers. The voices that are centered are the voices of mainstream feminism, which we've already outlined together here, the fucking issues with that, which is white supremacist feminism, misogynistic feminism. It's carceral feminism. Carceral feminism, yeah, believes that policing is a solution to anti-femme violence when the police is not a feminist institution. The police is the arm of white supremacist patriarchy. And oh, this
if
idea
that ever comes to me and is like, but Police are feminists. I just hope that I have a hot cup of coffee to throw in their face.
Like, which I'm sure, but if you think about it, and that's the whole fucking, like liberalism, liberal feminism, this whole idea that there are probably plenty of people that believe that, well, we just need more women on the police force and it'll be feminist. And it's like, no, we need no police. Like, feminism is not about, feminism is not limited to gender identity. Like, feminism is not limited to the sex of who is involved. And like because sex workers are so silenced across the board, we are not being heard when it comes to what we actually need as a global community.
And the fact that sex workers aren't at the front of labor movements is still wild to me, because they, like, as one of the most marginalized groups of people as far as like occupations go, it still sometimes boggles my mind that the people who are in the work of like organizing and advocacy and social justice sometimes like completely miss that boat. And hello, you just jumped from one boat to the other and like totally skipped an oar. And I think that people a lot of the times come at it with this savior complex, right? Like I'm trying to save the children. Meanwhile,
sex worker
so fucking
led...
much. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. I got it. Sorry. No. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. Sorry, Cecilia.
No, it's okay. I was just gonna say, meanwhile, you have people literally sexualizing children before they're even born. I literally commented on someone's post. I was like, meanwhile, all these people give so much crap about whether or not this child has specific genitalia, and it drives me fucking crazy. But sex workers are doing all these bad things. And then it's like, look inward.
That's patriarchy for you.
Yeah,
that's patriarchy. But and also the panic about human trafficking. The greatest irony about all of this is that sex work led groups, political groups, organizing groups are and have always been doing the most to actually address trafficking, because the more dangerous the world is for sex workers, the more likely we are to be thrown in jail or deported or whatever, the more underground we're forced to go with work. And having a criminalized sex industry actually creates the trafficking that these laws are purported to stop. And it's the conflation of the self-obsession of misogyny that is like the fiber that makes up patriarchy, this hero complex, this save the children complex, where like white Christian men are the leading policymakers and or their white Christian women counterparts. Like the leading policymakers around what happens to sex workers, with this narcissistic idea that they're saving people, which is, that's all whiteness is, just narcissism. It's this idea that it knows what's best for everyone. Oh yeah, I cannot.
Yeah, and which they created, right?
Yes. Like, which all that's
white people, right? Created, like, whiteness.
Exactly.
Oh boy.
Lord. Well,
so we know that, like, you just narrated just now, like, all the different ways that there's still a lot of, like, anti-sex worker information and conflation with trafficking. What can people do to help shift their thinking and maybe even the thinking of others?
Yeah, I think, and that's such an important question. Thank you for asking it. Tapping into sex worker-led organizations is a great way to start. There are so many. And like I said, like I don't call myself an activist. Like I'm certainly humbled by all that I don't know. I only am in the past like year coming familiar with a lot of these organizations. So there's so many that I don't know about. But I do want to point you guys to the Instagram account Soldiers of Pole, because they feature a lot of different groups around the world. I think that account is soldiers_of_pole. But if you just search Soldiers of Pole, they also have a podcast called Yes, a Stripper. There is Decriminalized Sex Work, which is an organization all dedicated to why, like, putting the power in the hands of sex workers and sex work leaders, the power into the hands of decriminalizing sex work would create an actual situation where we have labor rights. That's what New Zealand has done. There are still problems because it doesn't actually protect migrant sex workers in New Zealand, but that is why there are so many. That's why we have to listen to the people who know what the fuck they're talking about, what the problems are, because sex work advocacy actually involves working in cooperation with migrant advocacy and anti-border.
Which I have to say that I don't know how that, there's a part of me that, don't you all know this? Like, the people who have done this work, if you know this, you know who's supposed to be at the table. And so the fact that you're lacking people at the table just is another thing I'm going to side-eye.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To just understand, learning to train ourselves to understand that we should be side-eyeing situations and conversations about sex workers that are not featuring sex workers or that are only featuring anti-prostitution sex workers, because that's a huge like weapon that a lot of these like purported, like the anti-prostitution feminists use as front people. Traumatized sex workers who have left the industry and had legitimately terrible experiences in the industry and wanted to get out and are now anti-prostitution advocates themselves in terms of, we should shut the industry down. The solution is to get rid of sex work, which is not an effective solution. It does not work. And so being very wary and learning to discern what is, because anybody can be a puppet for white supremacy, patriarchy, oppression, like learning to discern not just who's saying it, but what they're actually saying, what the implications actually are. And if the implications of somebody's argument is we need more policing, that is not a pro-sex work position. That position will not make sex workers safer. Yeah, just tapping into resources that can point, like, this book is really great. Revolting Prostitutes is a first of its kind in many ways. Like, it's really a unique thing, and it's got a ton of resources. And so not only does it outline basically the 101 of what we all need to know in terms of what the main like bread and butter issues are in terms of keeping all sex workers safe, it also points to a ton of advocacy and organizations, but also just doing things like stopping jokes when they happen, saying something, speak up when somebody makes a dead hooker joke, speak up. These are not, or somebody laughs at a sex worker, laughs at a stripper, like devalues us in any way. If you're not a sex worker, and especially if you're a cis man, speak up.
Yeah. Yeah. The onus falls on the people who really end up benefiting from a lot of these awful systems.
Yeah.
So let's break it down. If there was like one big truth that you think people are just not ready to hear about sex work, and you're just like, bam, this is it, y'all better listen, it's about damn time you heard me, what would that be?
I feel like I ruined that climactic moment, because the truth is, it's work. Like, I feel like I've been belaboring that point for a long time in this conversation, but we have to think of it first as work. And that can radically change things for people. If they just make that small shift, it can radically change the way that they understand everything about gender equity, immigration equity, racial equity. If we could all, if Black trans immigrant sex workers, if the safety and liberty of Black trans immigrant sex workers is not central to everything we do, think, feel, and believe in. We are not embodying liberatory practices.
Boom, right there. That's it. Well, that's not it. I have some more questions. One more question. What are you currently finding pleasure in this moment?
Reading. So I've been in Boston for 10 days and I'm writing my book, and this was like just a writing and reading period. So I've been hanging out with my dad, which has been so awesome. I haven't been able to see him very much since COVID began. And I've just been laying on the couch reading for hours every day and then working on my book for hours every day and like eating spaghetti with my dad. And it's the best.
Oh, that's so good. I am so looking forward to when your book comes out, because I can only imagine. I can only
imagine how this
is going to be.
Thank you so much. It is a labor of love. I am humbled by how much work writing a book truly is, but it's really fun. And if anybody does want to stay up to date on the book, you can go to astrippersguide.com and sign up for my newsletter, and that will always have what's coming next for the book and when it's coming out and all that.
Nice. So please reiterate, this is actually my like last question. Please reiterate like how people can find you. What are the best ways people can find you?
Right now, Instagram is my main social media. A Stripper's Guide is my Instagram handle. And astrippersguide.com is my website. That's where you can get all the other info. I do life coaching. There's a page that I'm about to launch that is resources just for strippers and sex workers. So if you want to work with me, if you want to coach with me, if you want to book me for speaking or writing or teaching anything, you can do that all through my website.
Nice.
Or through Instagram. You can DM me too. It's fine. And my podcast, nice. A Stripper's Guide podcast. Please tune in. Love to have you.
Yes. This has been so good. I was like, I literally was like, do the bare minimum today because I just want to save all of my energy for this like hour with you.
Same. I was hanging hard with the cats earlier. So yeah, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for the chance to come and talk with you about this stuff. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me. And I hope that we get to see each other in person and or virtually again soon.
I know. Yeah.
Well, friends, it's time to go our separate ways. I hope you're feeling as satiated and stimulated from today's podcast as I am. Make sure you rate and review today's episode on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Lastly, head over to rawbarpod.com. That's rawbarpod.com to find out how you can connect with my guests and me and how you can be a part of the Raw Bar Regulars. See you next time.